Hello and welcome to this episode of the National Trust Podcast. I'm James Grasby, Curator of Buildings and Historic Landscapes for the Trust. Join me as we compare two remarkable estates that are at risk, the picturesque Blickling Estate in Norfolk, England, and the enchanting former palace Beit al-Razaz in the heart of Cairo, Egypt. We will meet the inspiring people who are responsible for protecting these cultural treasures from destruction through extreme weather events and political and social upheaval. Prepare to fly 4,000 miles from the UK to one of the historical centres of the Arab-speaking world in Cairo. Telling the story is producer Jesse Edbrook.
Cabin crew, prepare for landing, thank you.
The flight time is about 4.5 hours from London Heathrow. Emerging from the arrivals hall onto the streets of Cairo, the sights, sounds and energy of the place are immediately apparent. Traffic weaves frantically in and out as we take the highway from the airport to the historic quarter in the Old Town. The destination is a former medieval palace and family home called Beit al-Razaz. Since the 1960s, the property has been owned by Egypt's Ministry of Antiquities, and now it's looked after by the Egyptian Heritage Rescue Foundation. Architect and historian Obner Abdelbar is its manager and the visionary to restoring the property that had fallen into disrepair. She's invited Heather Jeremy, the general manager of National Trust's Blickling Estate, to join her. The properties have been twinned by the International National Trusts organization, or INTU, to share knowledge and insight in the fight against climate change on a program called Withstanding Change, funded by the British Council. We join Heather and Omnia in Cairo.
So welcome to Beit al-Razaz. I'm Omnia Abdelbar. I'm happy to welcome Heather.
It's good to be here. Hi.
So we are standing in the street of Beb el-Wazir. And you see in front of you this line of minarets. The minaret of the Blue Mosque. The minaret of Om Sultan Chaben, which is the mosque next to Beit al-Razaz.
Minarets are towers with distinctive designs. Everything from squat steeples to soaring pencil-thin spires that project the call to prayer. Cairo is called the City of 1,000 Minarets.
It's so beautiful.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite busy out here.
It's always busy.
And there's little cafes, little workshops.
Yeah, Cairo has always been busy.
Yeah.
Omnia trained as an architect and historian specializing in the Mamluk period of Egyptian history. Beit al-Razaz was originally constructed by the Sultan Kaibei in the mid-15th century.
I'm going to take you now into our entrance alley.
So yeah, this is a pretty big wooden door that we're about to go through. I mean, it feels a little bit like leaving the busy street behind, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
We're now going down into this corridor and it just feels a bit darker and almost a little bit quieter. Wow, look at this. Oh, it's absolutely beautiful, this big, huge, open courtyard space. There's so much going on, I don't quite know where to look first.
Yeah.
In Cairene design, the courtyard serves many purposes. For instance, it's a cooler space used for gathering and working, with a through breeze to other spaces in the house for cooling. Omnia explained that in many ways it was the heart of the house. It also bears a core principle of Islamic design, that the facade is not glamorous, but the inside is where the beauty and uniqueness is to be found.
The way to enter places is never direct.
Mm-hmm.
You never enter and then find a place. You have to go through small little alleys. Even Sultan Hassan, which is the biggest mosque from this period, you enter, then you go left, then you go right, then you go left, and then you find the courtyard. And it's as if it's preparing you to what you're about to see.
So one of the things that is really striking about this courtyard, firstly, is it's so quiet compared to the really noisy street outside. But also everywhere I look, I see these layers of history that have built up over time, whether it's an archway that looks like it's been blocked, or there's, you know, an inscription here, paintings there. It's just these beautiful layers of history.
We're trying to keep as many layers as we can. So you have the window from the inside and then a window from the outside. It's part of the history of the place.
Mm, definitely.
But climate change is now threatening Cairo's historic buildings such as Beit al-Razaz. Instead of hotter weather damaging the structures, heavier bouts of rain have caused problems in a city where flat roofs and no drainage are the norm. The corner house is an important three-story section of Beit al-Razaz that was damaged when the houses adjoining it collapsed in an unseasonably heavy thunderstorm in 2020. The corner house was dismantled and is being rebuilt brick by brick, as can be heard by the background sounds.
So this used to be, we call it the corner house, which connects with the houses which are overlooking the street. And the house next to us collapsed because of the amount of rain that we are experiencing and because people are not used to do maintenance like checking their gutters and checking their roofs and even isolating their roofs.
The core philosophies of architecture and design in the UK and Egypt are being stretched, and now they are learning from each other.
In Egypt, we always think, how are we getting rid of the heat? And in Europe, we're always thinking, how are we keeping the heat? So it took me a while to understand the wall system. Mm-hmm. In Egypt, in the medieval times, we built thick walls because we wanted to create cool areas in the inside, while in here, we wanted to isolate them from the cold outside.
The important work of restoring Beit Arezaz is organized by the Egyptian Heritage Rescue Foundation. It was started by volunteers to protect cultural heritage from looting and destruction. This became a major issue when the Arab Spring started in 2011 and people rose up to overthrow the government. In the chaos and political upheaval that followed, different factions protested and fought. Omnia shares the details of the truly dramatic day that was the catalyst to meeting the EHRF team and changing the course of her life.
On the 24th of January 2014, a car bomb took place in front of the Museum of Islamic Art. The target was the security building of Cairo.
It was a huge bomb attack.
It was 6 a.m. The sound woke me up.
And on this side of the road, you can see the historic facade of the Islamic Museum of Art, which has been severely damaged by this blast.
I opened the windows and I saw smoke coming out of downtown. And I looked at Twitter and they said the security building was hit. And then I looked at my husband and said, the museum is in front of the security building. I have to go.
The attack took place outside one of the most important museums for Islamic art in the world.
Well, you can see a huge crater that was left after the bomb blast. It blew through the concrete and twisted metal can be seen everywhere.
What happened with the explosion is that we lost all the windows.
The doors and windows of the museum were destroyed. Thousands of protesting Egyptians surrounded the museum. In the chaos, there was a danger that people would move in and steal the artifacts to sell on the black market.
We weren't sure if the army will be able to secure the place.
Since we arrived, riot police have been attempting to control the crowds.
Despite the extremely dangerous situation, the team of EHRF gathered at the museum to try to save the priceless artifacts. These brave volunteers realized that they were the last line of defense and had to move the artifacts to a secure location inside the museum. Omnia, who was not yet part of the team, had just arrived at the museum to see what she could do to help.
And I remember the museum director looked at me and said, so who are you? I said, Omnia. Omnia what? Abdelbar. I'm just a citizen concerned about her heritage, and he was so sweet. He said, okay, get along and work.
In the chaos inside the museum, Omnia had a chance encounter with the chairman of the EHRF, Abdul Hamid.
I saw Abdul Hamid, who's our chairman, and then I looked at him and said, okay, what do you need? And he said, I need boxes, I need bubble wrap, I need pencils and papers.
In such a high-pressure situation, where could Omnia find enough bubble wrap to secure 1,000 priceless pieces?
Next to the museum, there is an area called Nasiriyya, which is actually medieval from the 14th century. We have a saying in Arabic, you find everything from the needle to the rocket. And over there, you have lots of carpenters and people do lots of woodwork, so eventually they have bubble wrap. And the funny thing, I didn't have money, but I saw someone else who came from another institution. He said, I have money. So we went together and I was holding the boxes, like proper ancient Egyptian, everything on my hand and walking inside the museum.
Back at the museum, the police had secured the building and the teams inside were smashing glass cases that held more than 1,000 artifacts. It was then that another serious setback occurred.
Because of the fire system, you had water coming down the ceilings, so we were underwater, and at the same time we have everything, you were walking on broken glass and broken windows.
Despite the almost overwhelming odds against them, the EHRF team worked tirelessly. As the day wore on, artifacts that were at risk of water damage were moved first. Then gradually, the glass cases were smashed and the rest of the items were then wrapped and moved to a secure location in the museum. Everything was documented before it was removed and numbered when it was stored.
It was a very emotional experience for me because I was collecting objects I know so well, cracked, broken, and in pieces. There is one specific piece that is now restored, thankfully, with his name on it.
Kai Bey was the sultan who originally built Beit al-Razaz and ruled Egypt for a few decades.
I remember collecting it from the rubble and holding it in my hand after I secured it in a box. And now that it's restored, I always have to go and see it, and as if I'm saluting it in a way, say, hello. It gives me hope because, you see, after all the destruction we've seen, the museum is now open and is fabulous and a wonderful place to be.
Incredibly, the team succeeded in saving every artifact in the museum and the protesters didn't break into the building.
It's a day I will never, never, ever forget. I'm grateful I had this experience because the day-to-day is not easy, but when you remember that you lived a catastrophe and now it has changed completely, it gives you hope. It will not always be that negative.
I asked the head of the Egyptian Rescue Heritage Foundation why he risked his life to save the artifacts. And he responded, "If we can protect our history and through it understand our past, then nobody can manipulate our future." The experience of working with other Egyptians who risked so much to protect their history propelled Omnia to a life-changing decision.
That day, and after working with all the team of EHRF, I felt how genuine they are, how loving for Egypt, you know? And immediately I told Abdelhamid, okay, what do you need? He said, we need money, we need to do more training. So I started by fundraising for the foundation.
After successfully fundraising for EHRF, Omnia decided to dedicate her time to restoring the property we've been exploring earlier in the episode, Beit al-Razaz. We rejoin Heather and Omnia in the courtyard at a celebration of the work completed on the property so far. They have also been sharing their findings on climate change adaptation for heritage properties with dignitaries from around the world.
I'm Gareth Bailey, the British Ambassador to Egypt. You know, when I was here last in the 90s, the whole place was a ruin. What we've got today is nothing other than an oasis, because all around us is a teeming city of 25 million people, and then right in the heart of it, there's just a perfectly calm, beautifully restored courtyard with a charming garden, and it's just a place I think people will see as a refuge.
I'm called John de Koning, and I work as part of the evaluation and support team for this project on withstanding climate change. If you'd been here yesterday, you would have seen a large group of small children moving around the place and learning how to plant drought-resistant varieties and things like that. It was very nice. On this site, they would find a piece of their history and a piece of their identity. And what more can you expect?
The time arrived for Heather to leave, but not before giving an invitation for Omnia to visit Norfolk for the next chapter of the exchange. On the way to the airport, Heather shared her observations and takeaways from the trip.
I'm currently on the bus, having left the hotel and making my way to the airport at the end of my trip to Cairo. I feel really overwhelmed by the experiences that I've had. One of the things that I've really taken away from, especially having those conversations at Beit al-Razaz, is the work that they do with community and with local people, with young people, talking to them about the site and mixing into that an understanding of the impact that climate change is having. It's something that we want to do more of at Blickling. It's something that we're starting to do. But actually, I think they're just miles ahead of us in terms of really understanding how to bring those messages to the people around them.
Over the following months, both Heather and Omnia were busy restoring and managing their respective properties. Before long, it was time for Omnia's return visit to Norfolk, England, and the picturesque Blickling Hall. It's a magnificent Jacobean mansion with a rich heritage. Similar to Beit al-Razaz, it was constructed centuries ago and needs constant maintenance to fight climate change. It possesses one of the most important libraries in England with over 12,000 books. Omnia was hoping to gain more insight into how Heather and her team were adapting to the challenges of climate change.
Hi, Omnia. It's really great to see you again.
Thanks, Heather. And I see the rain is not leaving us.
No. So here we are at Blickling. And one of the things we'll be talking about today is rain and the effect it has on our buildings and on our gardens. And actually, the rain is quite heavily falling at the moment.
Yeah, it's a good start.
Yeah. So we'll get our brollies up. And we will go up for a walk up the front drive and show you the house.
Yalla, let's go.
Righty. And now you'll have to walk over one of our many makeshift streams that occur when it's raining. On the left is the wall to our orchard and walled garden. That has been a kitchen garden for the hall since the 1600s.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah.
And do we know what sort of things they were planting and did it change?
One of the great stories is that when we had glass houses along one of the walls, there used to be a competition between us and another country estate in the area who could grow the best pineapples.
You wouldn't think pineapples growing in such weather.
Although, speaking of climate change, you never know, we might be able to grow pineapples soon.
The Blickling Estate is over 4,600 acres, and Blickling Hall is among the many buildings looked after by the National Trust on the land. Originally constructed in the 17th century for Sir Henry Hobart, it came into the National Trust's hands in 1940 by Philip Kerr, Lord Lothian. It welcomes hundreds of thousands of visitors annually.
I like to call this front drive bit the warm hug of Blickling. If you look at how the two wings come down the side and the mansion is there, it feels almost a little bit like the wings are coming round to give you a Blickling hug. As we're going to cross over the bridge, you'll see that there's two bulls here. These are the Henry Hubbert bulls. So he was the first real owner of the estate of Blickling, but they're kind of also based on the Boleyn bulls. So, you know Anne Boleyn?
Yes.
Famous Anne Boleyn. She was born here.
How interesting.
Yeah. Actually, she wasn't born in this house. Anne Boleyn was born at Blickling, as far as we know.
Yeah.
But it was a different house at the time.
The bull is a symbol that the Hobart family used, and historical records suggest it was from a desire to associate themselves with Anne Boleyn, whose family's symbol was a bull.
Omni, I'm really excited because I'm about to take you into Blickling Hall. And we're about to go and knock. Then we can show you around some of our fantastic spaces and talk about actually how climate change is affecting them.
The rain has stopped.
It's letting up a little bit.
Yeah, we need to open our umbrellas.
So, Omnia, why don't you knock on the knocker for us
and
someone
knockers.
Will let us in. Hello, we've... just been greeted by our property curator, Megan Dennis.
Hi, Megan.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Omnia.
Nice to meet you.
I'm from Cairo.
Over the years, Blickling Hall has seen many owners and even housed soldiers during the Second World War.
Okay, Omnia, here we are. We're in the Great Hall of Blickling. I think it's pretty spectacular. What do you think?
It's very impressive with the coloured glass in front of us.
Heather and Omnia note similarities between Blickling's ornate ceilings and window decorations and those at Beitar Azaz. The murals in the main library of Blickling Hall are likely to have been influenced by Victorian Egyptomania, featuring Egyptian plants and animals.
They're actually canvas panels applied onto the ceiling.
Really? Because we have a canvas ceiling as well in Beitar Azaz, and it's very, very weird to find such a thing. I don't think it exists anywhere else in Cairo.
Yeah. And we have a spare one kind of rolled up in the stores as well.
I'd love to see that.
That canvas one at Beitar Azaz is that beautiful chevron zigzag pattern, isn't it?
Oh, like stunning. In a Sony ceiling.
It is, yeah.
Blickling Hall suffers from similar water-related issues to Beitar Azaz, with the drainage systems in the roof unable to cope with the amount of rainfall. Damp leaks into the house called water ingress. This creates a perfect environment for invasive bugs.
We're trying to do a lot more work with engaging young people and families. It's kind of under the banner of conservation conversations. Say that 10 times fast. but it was all about bugs. Because one of the things that we faced, especially with water ingress and humidity levels, is lots of bugs. And so it was connecting particularly young people from the local schools and areas like that with the impact that bugs have on our buildings and collection.
Here's Megan Dennis, the property curator.
We've been monitoring pests within the house for decades, and in the last couple of years, we've really noticed enormous increases in the number of silverfish in this room, which is a real concern because of the hand-painted wallpaper. These little creatures, they vary between kind of 5 millimetres to about 10 millimetres long. They look a little bit like wood lice. They're kind of silvery, hence the name, and they've got two little things that come out of their back end. You commonly see them in a kitchen or a bathroom because they like it where it's nice and damp. And so we now have silverfish infestation as a result of the water ingress above. They're coming in, they're loving all the damp wood, then they're coming down here and they're loving all the juicy wallpaper, which is a real issue. We can't stop them coming in. They've got the perfect habitat here. What we try and do is get rid of them as quickly as we can before they do too much damage.
So how do you get rid of silverfish as quickly as possible?
We use a desiccant powder, but we dry them out. Basically, they kind of get dried and then we just hoover them up.
We're now outside of the hall. I hope you had an amazing time looking around inside.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
And we talked a little bit about all of the issues we have with water management here, and really proud of a project that we've just completed, all to do with how we manage water.
This is Catherine, who was head of this National Trust funded project as an example of climate adaption best practice in heritage buildings, to explain more about what was going wrong and the danger posed to Blickling Hall.
And historically, if we had prolonged heavy rainfall, it would be so wet here, the water would be nearly up to the window level in the basement, and we would have the fire brigade here pumping out, and it was a regular occurrence.
So how did the team go about fixing this issue?
Yes, so it kicked off a couple of years ago with actually some repairs to the lake wall that we needed to do, and we needed to drop the lake level, and we couldn't do it because the sluice was broken.
The sluice is a sliding gate in the dam wall that can be opened or closed to let out water from the lake.
So that then sparked a larger piece of work to fix the broken sluice, and in doing the sort of pre-work on that, we realised that the lakeside culvert was completely blocked, and that takes all of the surface water from the gardens and the mansion.
After discovering that the main drainage tunnel for the water was blocked, emergency work went ahead to try and clear the blockage. The team used a remote-controlled drain inspection vehicle to check the 300-metre distance. The findings were surprising.
It starts off a big brick culvert, about 300mm diameter, and then when they replaced the final section, they put a clay pipe in that was about half of the size. So when you get a lot of water charging down the culvert, it suddenly meets a point where it gets a lot smaller, and that's where all the sludge and the silt will then gather, and that was blocking up the pipe.
A culvert is a tunnel-like structure that directs water away from a road, railway or building to prevent flooding. It can be in different forms, such as a pipe, tunnel or ditch.
So we cleared that, which enabled us to get into the lake. We had to dam the lake, so we've drained the top end of the lake, we've repaired the wall, we've replaced the sluice, got all of that functioning.
The work was soon put to the test.
And during that work, then we went through three major storms, and for the first time in, I think, 20 years, the basement didn't flood because we'd cleared the surface water culvert.
Congratulations.
So we were, time we had the high rainfall, we kind of looked around the project team and looked at Heather and went, we think we might have fixed the flooding problem, but we're not going to get too excited. And then after the second heavy rainfall event, we did have some high fives at that point. Yeah. And so I think we've cracked it. And then after the third one, we were actually quite relaxed going, I think we've solved the problem. Yeah, let the rain come. So we now know that that lakeside culvert is absolutely key to keeping the mansion dry. Mm. And also now we can lower the lake levels so we can preempt heavy rainfall, and we can actually lower the lake so that it's got more capacity because it will take all of the water runoff.
The project was successful and the team now regularly clean the clay culvert to allow the water to flow through. But it is showing signs of wear, so it will need to be replaced soon. The fight to keep Blickling Hall from flooding will continue. Heather shared her thoughts on the work so far.
This project is gold star all around because from concept through to completion was, I think, what, 18 months?
In the heritage world, that's a very speedy project.
It was so important that we got on top of that conservation of the lake wall.
It's quite a delicate process, but it's all underground and underwater, and you spend a lot of money and you don't see a lot of change other than knowing that the water's going where it needs to go.
I have to say, it's a lot of work. That's quite impressive. Well done.
Thank you.
When these places were built, they didn't anticipate the amount of rainfall that we're now seeing. So that's that other added kind of headache that we now need to look at.
After the tour of Blickling, Heather and Omnia shared what they feel they have gained from the twinning so far.
For me, straight away, I'm seeing a team, and I'd love to see a team in Beitar Aziz as functioning and loving as the Blickling team. And I think I was just telling Heather, I'd love to know as well how engagement to your volunteer system must be also something very exciting to explore. We don't have that volunteer system yet. So yeah, so I think for me, it's just that seeing that a team exists, that encourages me to create my own.
I am endlessly impressed by you, Omnia, actually. Just when somebody cares so much. I really like the way that you were kind of invite people into Bates El Rezar because you know once they get in there, they're going to understand it, they're going to love it, and they're going to want to help. Isn't it interesting? It's about people. Climate change is real. We're seeing the impact of it. We can share the practical stuff. We can share things about, you know, here's a report I did and here's my monitoring. But actually, all of that is driven by people.
Totally, yes.
Yeah.
What an inspiring place to end this episode. A relationship built between people who are now friends and between cultures that are vastly different, but facing each challenge together. If you want to find out more about the INTU twinning partnership, Bait El Rezar or Blickling, please search for INTU Withstanding Change or INTU on the National Trust website. The Withstanding Change project has been funded by the British Council. To hear more episodes of the National Trust podcast, please subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, goodbye.